even if somebody says, well, I'm not a runner and I haven't run since I was in, you know, high school, they still know that experience of running. So they know, they understand the physical act of running. So I think the what is relatable. The magic comes from the sort of the where, the when, the why in particular. So we all know what it's like to run. Then somebody starts telling you a story about the 250-mile race that they did. You're like, what?
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. Something that's very interesting about this particular moment in sports media is that so many approaches are possible if you judge things right. It can all be a matter of matching form with content, context and community, understanding what stories you're going to tell to which audience and how you're going to reach them. Like the Wind is a quarterly magazine dedicated to stories about running and running culture. It seeks to marry long-form original writing from around the world with high-quality imagery in a premium print product. And it stayed pretty tight to that course for more than 10 years, as counterintuitive as that may have seemed against the backdrop of inexorable digital proliferation. In fact, it's just hitting its stride, with thousands of subscribers across 40 countries, a Japanese language version now in print, and more local editions launching in North America, France, and Germany this year. Our guest this time is Simon Freeman, Like the Wind's co-founder and publisher. He lays out its inspiration and why he remains as committed to its vision as ever. He also explores why physical media is finding a clearer position in the marketplace, discusses what he's learned about Like the Wind's audience, the role of digital connection and in-person events in maintaining its community, and just what it is about running that makes for great storytelling. There's a bit about audio in there as well, if you listen carefully, and overall, some really quite illuminating stuff to reflect on. Before we get to it, we've got our own little niche community here, and it'd be great to keep that growing. I've had a couple of lovely notes from listeners since we came back from the break saying how much they're enjoying the podcast. Once again, very gratifying to hear that from you. But do make sure you're telling other people as well. Subscribe, rate and review on your platform of choice. Social media details in the show notes, of course. And if you want to get involved in any way, do feel free to get in touch. Right, enough of that. Fun conversation to dive into now. Here is Simon Freeman. So you're in Switzerland?
Yes.
Yeah, whereabouts?
So I'm in a small town in the Jura Mountains on the French border called La Chaux-de-Fonds, which not too many people have heard of. It's for, sort of famous for the analog watchmaking industry.
Right.
But it's a beautiful town and we're at 1,000 meters above sea level in the town. So, and then it's surrounded by hills. So
yeah.
Good for runners.
Good for altitude training.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not great for beginners, although I guess like any of these things, if you start up there and then you're kind of doing your runs closer to sea level, then it gets a little bit easier. Is there a kind of tension given the, you know, the smartwatches and the Garmins and everything else? Do you ever feel a tension or a guilt running past all these watchmakers who are painstakingly fitting cogs next to each other and all the rest of it?
Yeah. Do you know what? It's a really interesting, there's a sort of a parallel there with the publishing world because the watchmaking world has been through two crises. One, which was called the quartz crisis, when primarily Japanese watchmakers put batteries in watches, and the Swiss manufacturers were like, well, that's not going to last, is it? That's a fad. We're going to keep making mechanical, what they call automatic watches, you know, where your movement on your wrist drives the watch. And of course, quartz watches are much cheaper, more reliable. Like if you want to tell the time accurately, go and buy a 20 quid, you know, digital watch. Don't go and buy a £200,000, you know, high horology watch. So they, but you know, some of the brands that killed off a few brands in the same, you know, and then some survived, and then I think now they've sort of been dealing with another crisis, which is the Apple Watch, the fact that, you know, Garmin's and Suntos and all of those sorts of smart watches, sports watches, are now worn by people as their everyday watch. The thing is, the watch industry used to sort of survive because it was ubiquitous. If you wanted a watch, you bought a mechanical watch because that's what was available. There were no alternatives. And a lot of brands, when they were faced with the quartz crisis and the kind of emergence of sports watches and digital, you know, Apple Watch and what have you, hadn't sort of really adapted. But if you're a mechanical watch fan, you know that you can't buy a Rolex for love nor money. Like, they are just impossible to get hold of. And I think what's happened in the watchmaking world, and there is a parallel here to publishing, which I'll get to in a second, is watches have become like a status symbol and something that people are interested in. And they are, you know, really kind of regularly referred to as male jewelry. You know, men will, if they don't wear anything else, they might wear, like I wear, a wedding ring and my mechanical watch. They're my two bits of jewelry. So some brands in the watchmaking world have adapted to that, and they're doing all right. They're doing not bad, thanks very much. You know, Rolex being literally by far and away the number one in that regard. So, and I think what's happened in publishing is there was a period when publishers benefited from the fact that if you wanted to read, you know, about a topic that you were interested in, you bought a magazine. That was it. There was nothing else. And the publishing industry has then sort of dealt with television, and then the sort of, you know, the big digital, you know, change that's happened in the world, especially with social media. And some publishers haven't really adapted because they were trying to take on this new technology head on, and they lost. I think other publishers, and I like to think that Like the Wind is in that space, have sort of adapted to this new world. And we're not selling a publication that is trying to replace Facebook or the internet. It's something else. It's about, you know, it's a luxury product. I think watches are the same. You know, Like the Wind is not a, it's got much less function. You wear a mechanical watch because you want to wear a mechanical watch, not because you're trying to tell the time. And you buy Like the Wind not because you're trying to find out the news or the latest kind of, you know, release from a shoe brand. That's not what we do. We sort of serve a different purpose.
Well, it's funny because it's going to sound like we've set this up now, but we genuinely haven't, because it's quite a rich analogy. Because the other thing that's happening with watchmaking and print is this sort of reverse. It's a reevaluation of where the value is and or where the purpose is and the qualities that the product actually has. You know, in watchmaking, I think I saw a Timex ad from sometime in the last couple of years where it was like, you'll only check it once or something like that. And it was, you know, the idea that you look at your watch rather than your phone to tell the time, and you're not suddenly on TikTok for 45 minutes or whatever.
Yes, that's true.
And something similar has happened in magazine publishing, I've noticed, where people are saying, this is a curated world and experience that we are building for you, where, you know, the limits of it are at the end of the page, and you can sit with this story and you can enjoy it and you know soak up the imagery and stuff like that. You're not going to have your attention drawn to an ad, or you're not going to think, oh, I wonder what the weather's like later, or, you know, you're sitting with this now until such time as you put it down.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me is the ultimate luxury. That's effectively what we sell. Is, I say to people all the time, can you spend an hour a week, not an hour a day, an hour a week sat without your phone, without the telly on, just reading something, right? And if you spend an hour a week, coincidentally, 3 months later, you'll have read everything in Like the Wind magazine, and then a new one will land on your doormat if you're a subscriber. It's like, wow, cool. Like, I'm not suggesting that people are not going to be online. I'm not suggesting that people are not are going to sort of, you know, not watch Netflix or whatever. What I'm saying is, can you afford yourself half an hour or an hour a week of quiet time, you know, just sitting with something. Yeah, no notifications, no pings, no temptation to click around and check out what else is going on. But it's a luxury, you know. We hear it all the time. I sort of speak to people and they say, I love the idea of Like the Wind, but I don't have time. I'm like, wow, you can't find an hour a week to sit with a magazine. That's wow. Wow. You must be the most productive person on earth. It's nuts, isn't it? But I understand I get it. I understand the feeling that people have, because I think that what especially digital media has done is it's done a really good job of, you know, inserting itself into people's lives in a way that they feel like they have to be online all the time. And therefore they don't have time for other stuff. And I'm like, that's not the law. That's just something that these social media, you know, these especially social media platforms have kind of convinced us.
They're taking a lot more than an hour a week as well. That's the media environment that you're in now. Like the Wind's been around for a little over a decade. What was it that inspired it in the first place?
Other magazines, honestly. So my wife and I got married and we didn't have any money. So we ran the, for people that are in the sort of know the running world, we ran the UTMB route, the Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc. The Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc is this mythical race that happens every year. You start and finish in Chamonix, but it actually follows a long distance hiking route called the TMB, the Tour du Mont Blanc. And so we, Julie and I, decided that over 3 days or 4 days, we would run that route, staying in huts. So you're just running for 6 hours. And one of the topics that came up was Julie was saying to me, you buy a lot of these magazines. Like you're buying cycling magazines and surfing magazines and mountaineering magazines, but you run 100 miles a week and you don't own a bicycle, let alone a surfboard. Like what's that all about? And I said, well, I love the format. I just love the format. I like the idea. I love reading books. But to me, a book is a commitment. Is, you know, you're going to have to read a portion of it, remember what you've read, pick it up again quickly enough that you haven't lost the thread. Otherwise, you end up rereading chapters, which I find annoying. A magazine, I love the idea that you pick it up, you read a story in one go, put it down. There's no, that's it, done. It's very neat. And I love the feel of the magazine. So anyway, Julie said to me, well, why, but you're not reading running magazines. And I was like, well, no, because the running magazine for me doesn't exist. And again, I think that anyone that sort of launches a business 12 years ago, their sort of founding story can develop a degree of patina. But this is the absolute truth, because Julie and I had already started another business together. Hence, we didn't have any money. Hence, our honeymoon was running around a mountain. Julie said, we should launch that. We should create that magazine then. We can, because if we've got our own business, we can do what we want. How hard can it be? That was in the September, and we launched Like the Wind issue one the following February. Had a launch party in London. So that was the start of it, and we did it in the face of the sort of a surge of digital media that was happening 12 years ago. And in fact, the slightly odd reality is that the business we'd already launched, our first business, was in that digital marketing space. We were helping endurance sports, running, cycling, and outdoors brands, you know, reach and engage with potential customers through digital media. That's what that business was. So it was like we would often say that we had this sort of evenings and weekend project, which was the magazine, and almost felt like we were like there was sort of a form of betrayal, because we spent Monday to Friday, you know, in our first business, helping brands with Facebook campaigns and how to navigate emerging social media channels like Instagram. And then we'd come scurrying home in the evening and sit there and work on a ink on paper magazine. But yeah, that's how it started.
Yeah. And did you have, you know, it has a particular identity now, which is it's premium, it's a quarterly, which always helps with in that respect. But, you know, it's longer form storytelling, and it is storytelling. It's not sort of tips and, you know, here's what does the new Vaporfly do for your half marathon time kind of stuff. Did you settle on that early, or did that sort of take a little bit of time to work its way through?
No, we launched in that long form storytelling kind of run culture space. And there was two reasons for that. One is we were very, very aware of what was happening in the digital world. And we were like, well, if we're not going to be a daily newspaper, for goodness sake, like quarterly felt like the right cadence for a hobby, which was it was essentially a creative hobby. So we thought, well, quarterly feels about right. So we knew that we wouldn't be able to be more current than what was happening online, because obviously online you can just publish in the second things happen.
Yeah.
So we had to find another sort of reason for the magazine to exist. And the other thing was that whilst I said the running magazine for me didn't exist, running magazines existed. Runner's World is phenomenally well-known title in the running world. At the time in the UK, there was Men's Running, Women's Running. I think there was another couple. I mean, they've all gone now. But they did a brilliant job of product reviews, race reports, training tips. So we just thought, well, where's the space in the running world? And what was missing was what we wanted, which was that, you know, long form storytelling, that the sort of the stories that transport you into somebody else's life or into a different place, you know? So we started very intentionally, like literally issue one, the cover story. The story in issue one, from which we took the illustration that makes the cover, is a story about a guy called Simon Wheatcroft who lost his sight and is a runner. And sort of runs, or at the time ran, by feeling the paint on the road. You couldn't see him. And he was literally like, he was 100% blind.
Yeah.
And the story was about that, you know, and I was like, this is absolutely fascinating. Like, an amazing story. Still to this day, one of my favorites. So we started very intentionally with that in mind. And as I say, again, you know, hat tip to other titles, which we might talk about in a second, but other titles that we looked at and thought, yeah, we want that, but for running. And they already existed.
Yeah. So where do you look for now for those stories? And is there a Like the Wind kind of template story that you're trying to bring to your readers?
Yeah, I mean, the contribution guidelines now are much more sophisticated. They've had to become much more sophisticated because now we are inundated with people pitching us with stories. The shorthand version is the strapline on the magazine, which is on the cover of every issue, which is, it's why we run, brackets, not how to run. So it was almost easier when we started to say what we don't do. So we don't do product reviews. We don't do training tips. We don't do weight loss tips. We don't really do race reports in the sense of who came first, second, third. So we started off with that. Now our contribution guidelines are a lot more sophisticated, but they're around this idea of exploring running culture. So you're either exploring a place or you're exploring somebody's story, or we're talking about social issues through the lens of running. So one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is that when we started out, you know, like there was me, Julie, there was a lady called Imogen who I'd worked with my first job out of university. She was a sub-editor and I was an ad sales rep at the same commercial property magazine. And she got in touch with me via Facebook, how ironic, to say, I've seen that you've launched this thing. I've started running. I love it. Can I volunteer? So there was me and Imogen on the words side, and then Julie, and then a little later, probably around about issue 10, a guy called Alex Murphy joined the team as a designer working with Julie. But that was it. That was the whole team. For 10 years, we produced the magazine between the four of us. Real skeleton team. Now what's happened is that we've hired a publishing manager in the US. We've got an editor. We have a sub-editor. So Alex Roddy is our editor. And he's much, much, much better at the job than me, which is great. Always higher up. But what Alex does is Alex and Adrian, our publishing manager, they sort of have this sort of like three-dimensional, probably even four-dimensional kind of grid that they're thinking about all the time, which is, are we talking about road and track and trail running in relatively equal balance? Have we got as many female voices as male voices? Are we talking about a social issue? If so, what is it? How are we approaching it? Where are the stories from? Which part of the world are they from? They're trying to make sure that every issue kind of has that balance. So we're sifting through a lot of contributions, pitches, which is great. And then when we identify that perhaps there's a part of that four-dimensional grid or whatever it is that Alex and Adrian are thinking about that we don't have, thankfully now over the years we've worked with, I don't know, something like 500 or 600 different writers over 12 years. So we can then get back in touch with somebody and say, hey, there's a topic here. If you've got an idea for a story, we'd love to commission you. So it's a bit of both, basically, to make sure we maintain balance.
Yeah. Where are you finding that people want to contribute from? Are you getting runners who want to write, or are you getting writers who want to talk about running, basically?
Yeah, both. I mean, it would be naive of us to not acknowledge that the publishing industry as a whole in the running world has been through a really tumultuous time. So there's lots of people who probably had either regular gigs or even staff writer gigs who've been let go. So there's a lot more of those people who are professional writers who were in the running world who are now looking for places to write where they can make a living. And I really, really want to support that as far as we possibly can. And we are relatively limited. You know, we publish, I don't know, 120 stories a year over four issues. So we're not, you know, we don't have a huge amount of opportunity, but where we can commission a writer and pay them, we always pay them. We will, because if those people leave the sport, it sort of diminishes the storytelling ability of the sport, right? It if they're not there anymore, then who's telling the stories? Mm. So there's that. And then we do get lots of people who say, you know, after the number of emails we get from people who go, I'm not a writer, but ... And then their story is absolutely amazing. And I'm like, don't worry about it. Look, I called myself the editor of a magazine for 10 years. Absolutely no idea what I was doing. So don't worry. We'll either link that person with a writer who will commission, or, I mean, Alex, Roddy, the editor, and Adrian and Emily, our sub-editor, they're brilliant. Like, they'll take a story and be like, we've got this. It's all about the story. And I think the technical aspects of writing are relatively easy to sort of get right. It's the experience, it's the story or the message that someone's trying to get across that's so important.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite things that you've published in the last year, just to give people a flavor of what's coming out of Light the Wind?
So in the current issue 47, we have a story that was written. It's a profile of an athlete called Dina Castor, written by one of our contributors, Amory Rowe, who Amory actually was the editor of the first Light the Wind women's issue that we published. So when we got to 40 issues, i.e. 10 years, we decided that our 41st issue would be our first ever women's issue. And so we sacked me and we hired Amory as the editor. So it was an entirely female team producing the magazine. So anyway, Amory, who's an amazing wordsmith, like phenomenal, and also a fantastic runner in her own right, interviewed Dina Castor for a piece in issue 47. And yeah, that just a brilliant piece of storytelling about the career of somebody of Dina Castor's, you know, caliber. There's a story in issue 44 called Heartbeat of Hope Pass that was written by Zoe Rom. The reason I love that is that is a Hope Pass is a mountain pass in the Rocky Mountains. I've never been. It's on the course of a race called Leadville 100, which is a very, very famous, right, really storied ultramarathon, 100-mile ultramarathon. And that Hope Pass is a really significant point in the race. Zoe just, I don't even know how long the piece is, 2,000 words, but it's just beautiful. Like, you really feel like you're there. And then on that sort of social issue tip, we've got a piece in issue 46 by Micah Ling called Performance Pay Power, where Micah explores the realities for professional athletes from the perspective of trying to make a living. And, you know, we're sports fans. I'm a sports fan. I love the sport of running. And I'll sometimes ask people, you know, I had the privilege of being in the stadium at the London Olympic Games when Mo Farah won gold in the 10,000 meters. Well, one of the greatest moments of my life. And I'll sometimes say to people who are very, very deep in the sport, like Mo Farah won gold. Do you remember who won silver? Probably about half the people will say, oh, it was that American, wasn't it? You know, Galen Rupner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who came eighth? No one. And I mean, no one has ever given me that. I'd have to look it up now. And I'm like, this person was eighth in the Olympic 10,000 meter final. Like, that's an insane thing to achieve. No one knows who that person is. So this piece is sort of talking about the realities of how hard it is to make a living as an elite athlete. So those three have all appeared in the last year. But it's like, I could open any issue from the last four and pick six stories that I absolutely love. Like, we're really privileged to tell some amazing stories.
Yeah. Let's turn it around. Who's, if such a thing exists, is the typical like the wind reader? Because you know, it's interesting that you said at the outset you were reading surfing and cycling magazines despite not doing either of those sports. So, you know, it feels like maybe this isn't necessarily for people who are fascinated by, who will get up in the morning and kind of drag themselves around town or around a course. It may be for people who are interested in this sort of human endeavor at the other end, you know, the experience that's being described. But, you know, is there a strong overlap with the running community, or is it something else again?
I think I've got a few answers to that question. I mean, I believe, and we know this because now we're doing a lot more research into who our readers are, because we're trying to behave like a grown-up business. They are people for whom running is a really important part of their lifestyle. And that doesn't mean that they run 7 times a week, 8, 9, 10 times a week. You know, they're not necessarily people that are performance driven, but they are people for whom running shows up all the time in their lives. And, you know, those magazines that I was talking about, like, you know, the Surfers Journal, I suspect the Surfers Journal is read by a lot of people who get to go to the beach and surf on a Sunday once a week. Like, they're not pro surfers. They're not out there every single day. They don't all work for Patagonia, where they're allowed to down tools and leg it out the building when there's a kind of, you know, decent surf day. Like, the wind readers are those people who are probably happy 3 or 4 times a week if they get out for a 45-minute run. And then at the weekend, that's when they get to indulge. And they are the kind of people who really have an ambition maybe to do, you know, to race the New York Marathon or to participate in a big, you know, big high prestige trail race one day. You know, like the wind is out. We often, again, describe it as it's how they connect to the running world outside of running, which, you know, I think is true for a lot of the sorts of magazines that we compare ourselves to. There's a magazine out of New York called Racket. Beautiful magazine. They do a brilliant job of connecting people with the tennis world. I suspect the people that read Racquet play tennis once or twice a week. They're not, you know, they have lives, they're busy, but they're fascinated by the culture and the sport of tennis. I have also said in the past, and this sounds facetious, but it's true, they're people who have a coffee table. You can't have a coffee table magazine if you don't have a coffee table. And when I think back to when I was in my 20s, you know, you're super mobile, you're moving about, you're in shared accommodation, you know, shared flats or whatever. The last thing you want is, you know, 15 kilos of magazines to ship, schlep around, you know. But I think what happens is that as people mature in life, they move less often, they get a little bit more settled, they probably, you know, have a bookshelf. They're super lucky. They might even have a little you know, den where they can put their stuff. I'm that person, you know. By the time Julie and I got married, I wasn't moving every 6 months. I was a little more settled. I probably bought books that I kept, you know, that kind of stuff. But you buy art to put on the walls because you know you're not going to move every, you know, 6 months. So it's those sorts of people that they also tend to be people that are investing in running because it's such an important part of their lifestyle. So they are the people that will buy good quality gear that they feel performs well and they look good in. So it's that sort of slightly older kind of type of person, I would have thought.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a fascinating picture. And did you find, I mean, you know, the kind of spark for this was personal for you, but how did you find the process of building it out? Was it every time you found a collaborator, it sort of connected you, gave you a slightly clearer picture of what it was that you were trying to accomplish, or was there some serendipity involved in it? Or, you know, how do you reflect on that experience now, the pre-market research days, shall we say, of the community building?
There was an enormous amount of luck associated with it. I mean, we Julie and I will emphasize this. Julie and I were in a privileged position in the sense that we had a business, our own business. So we didn't need to make money from the magazine, which is really important. I meet people who will, I'll get emails from people all the time saying, hey, I'm thinking about launching a magazine. I'd love to pick your brains. And at some point I will always say to them, look, I'm really sorry, but there is a reality here, which is if you think you're going to launch something in, you know, an independent print media business and pay your bills, your mortgage or your rent or whatever, you're in for a rude awakening. Like, it's really, really hard work and not a great sort of financial initially. It won't work initially. But what we found was that because of our connection, I mean, my connections as a runner, like I started out as a blogger. I started blogging because I'd lived a very unhealthy lifestyle, quit and started running. And I thought, oh, this is the greatest thing on earth. And I set up a blog and would just write about it, you know, constantly, because I was so pumped by this new thing that I discovered called running. You know, once I'd started running marathons, oh my goodness, you couldn't stop me. I was doing all reviewing products and writing about all my training. It must have been so boring, but through that I'd started to develop some connections. So as soon as we launched the magazine, we were starting to get emails from people saying, wow, seeing what you're doing, that looks really interesting. Like, how can I be part of it? How can I support? Whether that is contributing a story or just sharing what we were doing with their friends. So we got a lot of peer-to-peer recommendation, mainly, I think, because we were serving a particular audience who didn't have any alternative product. There was nothing else. And the funny thing is, there still isn't. I mean, in this day and age where we're starting to see this massive resurgence in the interest in print media, there are other indie titles, other indie running magazines coming to the market, but there are none that are a direct competitor to Like the Wind, which is mad to me. So we sort of had the benefit of every time someone discovered Like the Wind magazine for themselves, they would tell three or four people. That's a gift, you know. That's so, you're so lucky if that happens. That's amazing, you know.
Yeah. What are some of the ways that you're sort of more proactively building a community now? Because you do obviously have a digital presence, you know, you've got an Instagram account and you've got events that you spin up, and you know, you're publishing in different territories and have people, as you say, in the US and Japan in particular, who are responsible for those territories. You know, while retaining that focus on a print product, what are some of the things that you have found are quite effective in building the real world community beyond that?
Well, this is, I mean, this is really the nub of the whole thing, isn't it? Distribution. Like, you can make the most beautiful magazine in the world, but if you can't tell people about it and they're not buying it, then it's all a complete waste of time. So this is the essence really of it. So we are doing paid social media and paid advertising, pay-per-click stuff, because I think you can't not do that. The main focus for us is in real life events. So organizing our own events, and we've got a big announcement coming for something that's happening towards the back end of this year. But I'm in London from tomorrow, and we're partnering with a brand called Acid Running, who have a pop-up on the King's Road, and they said, we'd love to have you in. So I'm hosting a storytelling hour on Friday night. We'll buy beer and pizza for anyone that wants to come down, and we've got three guests who are going to tell a story.
Yeah.
You know, live. That's a really big thing for us. That is absolutely crucial. We've held our summer party in Chamonix the day after the UTMB finishes every year for the last 13 years. Last year, it was glorious. We were at a venue that's got a big outdoor lawn, and it was beautiful sunshine at 6 o'clock in the evening. Everyone's had an amazing week. Perfect. I mean, so in-person events is really important. We're launching an audio product. We're not launching kind of this style of podcast. It's a bit different. It's more akin to an audio book.
Sure.
So that's coming up. I think we're trying to kind of push on sort of multiple different directions. So, you know, the truth is, if you understand and you ask the question, which I think was a great question, you know, who is your audience? Once you figure that out, then you just try and figure out where those people are, right?
Yeah.
And it's bad to make assumptions, but, you know, I don't think those people are on TikTok. Okay, cool. We don't spend a lot of time or money or effort on TikTok. So just try and figure out where those people are. The other opportunity that I think is massive, and it is not unique to running, but it's very specific to running, is specialty retailers. So another area of the running world that has been through a tumultuous decade is the specialty running world, specialty run retail world. You know, those stores that you go to, like I did, you know, when I discovered running as a 29-year-old pack-a-day smoker who was trying to turn his life around, somebody very quickly said to me, look, you need to go to this specialty running store in Camden and go in and have your gait analyzed and get someone to sell you a pair of running shoes, because you can't be running in, you know, Air Jordans. That's just ridiculous. Those stores have had a horrific 10 years of being undercut by online retailers, you know, big box retailers, et cetera, et cetera. They're now coming back. They are community hubs. They are people. They're very much like when I was a kid, I used to go to I'm a South London boy. I used to go to Bromley and hang out at the skate shop. I didn't have any money. I couldn't buy very much. You know, like I'd buy a set of trucks once a year or something, but I wasn't going in there. But I would be in there every single weekend, you know, maybe trying to get a sticker or buy a VHS or something.
Yeah.
These running stores are becoming those spaces where people, and like the wind in those spaces is a really interesting proposition, because someone can think, ooh, I could buy a 12 quid magazine. I don't need to buy a £250 pair of shoes every time I go. I mean, in fact, I can't, I'm not going to. So one of the things that we're working really hard on is how we build a network of specialty run retailers who stock the magazine. We'll promote those places to our readers. They're the sorts of spots. Those are the spots where we will go and do events. So if we're coming to a town, we'll find that specialty retailer, invite our community to come down for our sort of storytelling hour. So that is another channel where we're finding that, you know, those people that we think are the right audience for Like the Wind.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how that's, again, that's something that's recurring across multiple different cultures and multiple different sectors, you know, because the other space that I imagine a publication like The Wind does well is the specialty magazine shop, which is that's a very big city thing, I suppose, but it's again, it's where the Like The Wind reader might be, because they might want that sort of connection with that sort of story.
Yeah.
And that sort of premium way of putting it together.
Yeah.
But you do have that recurring is this idea that I suppose has kind of become, it's been powered by digital spaces. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's a niche out there if you find the right scale. And it's about matching a scale to a niche. And it's obviously harder to do in person, but it's more rewarding both kind of personally and financially, I guess, when given that people will actually hand over money for products.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a chap that I know called Peter Abraham, and he published a post quite a few years ago now about the nicheification of everything. I mean, Peter is deep in the endurance sports, outdoors running, cycling world. But he made the point that actually, if you can figure out how to access these niches, they don't look as attractive, right? If you're sort of launching a business and you say, look, what I'm really trying to target here is 25,000 people that are absolutely passionate about this topic. It's a big part of their lifestyle. And then an investor or whomever looks at that and is like, oh, I've got this other pitch over here where they're going to launch something that's going to have 25 million users. And you're like, the numbers don't look great. But, you know, as I always say to people, the number of subscribers we have to Like the Wind as a number doesn't look amazing. But I tell you what, I've got 100% open rate. Like, because it's in that community. And I think specialty retail, if somebody is launching a magazine and there is a specialty retail element to what they're doing, amazing, go yeah. for it. Somebody messaged me the other day, and I don't want to give anything away, but they asked me whether I could speak to them, give them a bit of advice, and they want to launch a magazine in the music world. And I was like, first things first, are there music shops that sell the product that you're planning on publishing this magazine about? And they said, oh, absolutely. And I was like, brilliant. That is such a huge step for you to get in those spaces where those people are going in to look at the thing, you know, to hang out with like-minded people. That's phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go back to the magazine itself. You know, we've talked about the storytelling aspect of it and where you get the stories from. But the thing about magazines in particular is that it's all brought together. It's a product that brings multiple storytelling and editorial and creative disciplines together. And that can be, you know, the photography and the selection of the photography and the graphic design, even down to stuff like, particularly for a quarterly, something like the paper stock.
Yeah.
You know, you want something that's different and more substantial. You know, I was having a conversation about this recently with Andy Afford, who works in a slightly more kind of generalist magazine space, but, you know, something that's going to live with you on your coffee table mm-hmm. for 3 months is going to be different from something that, you know, you buy with a cup of tea to while away half an hour.
Mm.
Like, what's the approach that you take to all of those different things, and where do you draw ideas from?
I mean, the selection, we talked about the story selection, the sort of the design, the visual selection, it has to go hand in glove with the types of stories that we're trying to tell. And again, doing that, being very mindful of the kind of people that are going to buy Like the Wind magazine. In terms of the quality of the magazine, the physical quality, the print quality, the paper that we choose, we're trying, the medium is the message, right? We're trying to kind of produce something that has got a sense of gravitas and value and I keep using the word quality, I sound like a broken record, but something that people are going to want to spend some time with, that doesn't feel disposable, it doesn't feel very throwaway. It feels like a collectible. Like, I'm just looking across the office here where I'm sat, and obviously I have a collection of 47 issues of Like the Wind magazine on a bookshelf. Issue one looks as good today as it did 12 years ago. The spine is all still in one piece. You know, it doesn't feel disposable. And the stories that we're telling are not timely. So we don't have a date on the magazine. It's just issue 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The stories we publish, they don't really have a time. They have a timelessness about them. People could pick up a copy of issue 7 today, and all the stories in it will be like, oh, amazing. You know, I mean, one of the things we had to navigate, not funny in a humorous way, one of the challenges we had to navigate was, you know, in 2020, 2021, we were just inundated with stories from people talking about the impact of COVID.
Mm.
And we were like, how is this going to age? You know, when in 10 years time, people are going to look back and go, oh yeah, that was weird. What was that all about? You know, so we have to be mindful of that. So, and I love the idea of somebody either collecting the magazine or passing it on. And if it's a, I don't know, does anyone ever pass somebody a newspaper or a little sort of, you know, cheap saddle stitched magazine? I don't think so. You just sort of tend to read it and recycle it. Hopefully you recycle it. So we wanted to create something that somebody would think, oh, that's, I've read that, it was great. I'm going to hand it to somebody, or I'm going to put it on a shelf and collect it and maybe revisit it. So we're always saying to our print partners, how do we increase or improve the quality of what we're doing? I mean, anyone that works in the publishing world knows that paper prices just seem to go up and up and up and up and up. But it's so fundamental to what we do. We will never, ever, ever compromise on that, because it would just undermine the entire concept for us to suddenly be printing on cheap paper and producing something that just feels thin and weedy. It doesn't, it would be the antithesis of what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And is that a similar thing to what you decide to share online and what goes in the newsletter and what goes on, you know, what's associated with those social accounts, that there'll be something, but it won't be the thing that lives in the magazine that is associated with, yeah, with those images and that paper, you know, that feeling of that tactile feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like I want to reward the people that invest in the magazine. So, you know, they're the ones that are supporting this mission that we're on, right? And they're the ones that are giving us the most valuable thing, which is that they're sitting for an hour a week and reading a magazine. I'm like, well, let's honor that by making what's in the magazine unique to what's in the magazine. And then what we're doing online is trying to give people who are not going to buy the magazine, and that's absolutely fine, by the way, that I have no issue with that, but because they can't have that tactile experience because they're not holding the magazine in their hand, then the stories that we publish need to reflect the fact that it's online, on digital, on social media, and be appropriate. We have a fortnight email that we send called Like the Wind Notes, which is a collection of stories that we've found from around the running world that we're collating. And they're much more news driven. They're like, this has happened in this period of time, you know, and it's like, because we know that someone will read that email. Oh, cool. That was interesting. Click on a link. Great. Done. Delete. Move on. I hope that nobody's collecting these emails. I don't think they are. The medium is sort of essential to the types of stories that we want to publish.
Yeah. On that point, what do you think it is about running that lends itself to great storytelling? What are people drawing on when you've had stuff that's, you know, come into your inbox and you think that's fantastic?
Mm.
What is it that they're drawing on?
So I think the first thing is that running is an almost universal experience.
Mm.
The vast majority of humans at some point have run, even if that was just when they were tiny little kids. I mean, you just, kids can't not run around, you know, generally that's the case. So I think we start from a position of, even if somebody says, well, I'm not a runner and I haven't run since I was in, you know, high school, they still know that experience of running. So they know, they understand the physical act of running, right? So I think the what is relatable. Then what the magic comes from, the sort of the where, the when, the why in particular. So we all know what it's like to run. Then somebody starts telling you a story about the 250-mile race that they did. And you're like, what? the fascination comes from something that we're all familiar with. And you're just like, I'm sorry. So that is what draws the, I think that's what makes running, and it's not universal in this regard, by the way, but I think it's what makes running something that is such a great canvas for storytelling. And then the act of running, it sort of lends itself quite neatly to this whole kind of hero's journey thing. Like if you run, actually even if a relatively short run, you know, you think you go out the front door for an hour and you leave and you think, oh, I feel amazing. And then you get a stitch or you hit a hill and it all gets a bit hard and then stuff starts kind of, you know, getting in your head, or it starts raining and you have to battle through, and then you get back, you know, to where you started, and suddenly you can, you know, have a cup of coffee and a hot shower and you're like, oh. So it kind of running lends itself quite neatly to sort of narrative arcs. There's a few things in there. I also think that what's happened with running more and more is it's become a platform that people use to explore. So I meet people all the time who are like, yeah, my dream is to go and run in the Mojave Desert one day and do an event, you know, a TSP event or something out there, or oh my goodness, you know, I'd love to go and run on the trails in Chamonix. It's sort of become a destination thing. You know, my dream is that one day I get to go and do the Tokyo Marathon, like the excuse to go to Tokyo. So again, storytelling and running lends itself quite well to this sort of transporting us to another place or another time or another person's experience.
Yeah. And how do you find that corresponds with the sort of regionality of what you're doing and the voices that you're bringing in from different parts of the world, from, you know, obviously you have a presence specifically in Japan, but and North America, but you will be getting contributions from everywhere, I presume.
Yeah, we do. We get contributions from absolutely everywhere, which is one of the joys of being the publisher, because I get to read them all. you know, amazing. Like what did I know about the running scene in Manila? I can tell you. I know something about it now. It's brilliant. I'd love to go running in Manila. That's on my bucket list. I'd love to do that. It's funny because this idea of running as a sort of a canvas for self-expression, and the idea that people run for different reasons, but ultimately the act of running is pretty universal. It's the same sort of one foot in front of the other. Means that with Light the Wind Japan, the way that it works is that Kiyo Fujishiro, who's the publisher in Japan, he takes stories from 12 years of Light the Wind and translates them into Japanese for an audience out there. And then that's about 80% of each issue. And then about 20% is him publishing stories that he's discovered in Japan. And we get the benefit then of being able to translate some of that 20% back into English for our magazine. But the themes feel pretty universal. You know, there's stories around as like place, people going to different places, people running for different reasons. We talk about, you know, the fact that we believe that running should be something that is accessible to everyone, and it's not by a very long stretch. You start publishing a magazine like Light the Wind and you realize that as a kind of, you know, middle-class, middle-aged white man living in a safe European country, my experience of running is not in any way, shape or form universal. Those stories, when Kiyo translates the words into Japanese, with a little exception of some concepts need to perhaps be explained more to a Japanese audience than a European audience. And the same between, you know, we're launching Light the Wind USA. As we're working on that, we're discovering that there's some things that an American, a US audience would just be like, oh yeah, I understand that. Whereas a European audience would need a little bit of cultural translation. But the themes are universal, right? You know, they're not, I've not yet come across somebody writing about run culture somewhere that I'm like, ooh, that doesn't chime with an audience somewhere else. The details will be different. You know, when you go running in Manila, you go at 3 a.m. because it's baking hot. You don't do that here in Switzerland, I can tell you.
Okay. Where do you hope to take the project next? What's on the horizon for you guys?
Well, so the big change is that Julie and I are no longer involved in the first business that we launched. So we are now full-time on the magazine. And that means that, plus the fact that I think long-form storytelling is seeing a resurgence, analog media is gaining popularity, and running has absolutely exploded in popularity, means that we're really excited about, you know, developing the business at the Like the Wind brand, if you want. So we are doing more events. We're, as I just mentioned, we're launching Like the Wind USA on the 1st of March. Ooh, that makes me feel anxious, just saying that out loud. The audio zine that I mentioned is coming out. So we're sort of pushing on multiple fronts to grow the sort of Like the Wind ecosystem, the number of ways in which somebody can engage with it and be part of the storytelling without losing the core of what we're doing, which is long-form storytelling about run culture, and the why we run. So it's taking what I think we've done relatively successfully in ink on paper for 12 years and just expanding out into different storytelling media is the plan.
But being quite judicious about where you put that, as you say, thinking about where it's going to match with what you've been doing so far and where your audience is likely to be, rather than just saying, we're going to put it out everywhere.
Yeah, and we're just keeping looking for spaces where there's an opportunity to serve an audience, rather than, ooh, somebody's doing that really well, let's go and try and do that. Because they're already doing that really well, so let's not go and try and do that.
Yeah. Why, just on that point, why was audio something that you felt, and that sort of audio storytelling? I mean, well, I suppose there's a natural fit, which is that people can listen to it while they're running. But
but that's it. That's it. It's like I love running with other people. I live in a small town in French-speaking Switzerland. I don't have the same sort of social network that I had when I lived in London for 45 years. So I run a lot on my own. And I always plug in a podcast or an audiobook. And I'm like, well, that's just a great opportunity. That's 45 minutes to an hour, four or five times a week. I could be listening to a story. So that is a really, really crucial reason why we're doing that. I think the other thing is that audio is a halfway house between, I personally don't believe that you can be scrolling on Instagram and answering emails and listening to an audio product at the same time. It demands a degree of your attention, not to the same extent that reading a magazine does, because if you're reading a magazine, I think you've got pretty do not read a magazine whilst driving. But you can listen to an audio book whilst driving or cooking. So it still demands a degree of focus on this thing, which I think is important.
Yeah, so it puts the story at the center.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks. Okay. That's perfect. Thank you. Can I steal that?
Three questions that we ask every guest on the podcast. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Well, specifically running, was waking up on Christmas Eve. I was not yet 30. I was turning 30 a few months down the road, and I was horrifically hungover. I had somehow got through at least one packet, if not two packets of cigarettes the night before, felt absolutely dreadful. And I thought, I need to do something today. Like, I've got to stop this. This is awful. I hate myself. Mm. And running was the very, very easily accessible. As I say, it was like a kind of, I had a pair of cotton rugby shorts. I cannot emphasize strongly enough, do not go running in cotton rugby shorts. They are awful. Really uncomfortable. But I had a pair of cotton rugby shorts, a hoodie, and I think, yeah, literally like a pair of Jordans or something. And I went for a run, and it was horrendous, but it sort of set me on a path. So my origin story was just using running as a life raft, really, to help me kind of push away from this life that I'd been living. I didn't know at the time that it was going to turn into what it turned into, but it became an absolute obsession. And is now my career. So it's kind of given me everything, honestly.
Mm. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
So I got two. I did actually, I knew you were going to ask this question, so I did prepare for this. So there's a book called The Rider by Tim Krabbe. Tim is it's like a Dutch chess grandmaster. And he wrote this book. It's a really slim novel, really slim volume of a bicycle race. And it's from the perspective of one rider. And he's sort of telling his life story, but also the story of the race as he goes and all these philosophical thoughts that are going through his head. It's absolutely brilliant. And I'm not a cyclist,
yeah.
But phenomenal piece of writing. And then another, a book that I read that I absolutely loved is a book called The Sweet Science by A.J. Liebling. That is actually a collection of essays that he wrote about boxing that were published in The New Yorker in the sort of 40s and 50s. So it's almost like a collection of magazine stories. So again, it's one of those things where when you read that book, you can sort of read a story. And it's about boxing, but it's not really about boxing, if you see what I mean. It's about life through the lens of boxing. A.J. Liebling, I would have loved to have gone and had a cocktail with him in a bar in New York in the 1940s, you know, before going to Madison Square Gardens to watch a boxing match. I think he would have been a fascinating character. So there's a couple. Yeah.
Cool. Great recommendations. And what's a sports story you'd like to tell or see someone else tell?
Well, again, knowing that you're going to ask this question, I'm slightly cheating. I'm going to say stories because I really think the sport of running has lost its way from a storytelling perspective. I think that, and there's many reasons for that. I don't know whether they're sort of cause or effect, but, you know, I think back to, not back in prehistory, but like I think about Joan Benoit Samuelson and her story winning the inaugural women's Olympic marathon in LA in 84. Like, that was an amazing achievement. And the way that story was told, it kind of resonated for decades. It kept inviting women into running. Or I don't know whether you're old enough, I'm old enough to remember Steve Avett and Seb Coe, like, you know, taking chunks out of each other. And it was a cultural moment. Like, people who didn't really have much interest in running understood that rivalry and they wanted to be part of it. And it was polarizing. You were either a Seb Coe guy or you're a Steve Ovette guy. You know, you, again, from a storytelling perspective, amazing. So I think my answer to the question is, I think when you look at the elite end of the sport, there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of stories that could be told. And what we get is a very functional so-and-so one in a time of X, broke course record. I'm like, how do we get behind that to sort of who these athletes are? Because they're phenomenal people. Like, they're all amazing to do what they do. And I know, as a kind of amateur runner, like, to do what they do is incredible. So I always sort of think to myself, there's thousands, if not millions, of stories that could be told. I think I've swerved your question, but there's loads of them, and I it frustrates me that, like, the Wind magazine doesn't have the capacity to tell more stories than it does. I mean, we do the best job we can with the limited capacity that we have. As I said earlier, you know, 120 stories a year probably. But I couldn't answer that question with one. I'm going to say thousands.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You'll keep doing your part anyway, I'm sure. And you know, one foot will follow the other as it does.
If the team's listening, we're going to go monthly. No, I'm joking.
On that bombshell. Simon, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks very much for taking the time.
I appreciate it. And thank you for the work you do with the podcast, because I've been gorging listening to the episodes. They're really good.
Good to hear. All right. Cheers, Simon. Outlines is an original production from 2640.